You don't have to be the one to see it. He tried one last time to persuade him, but Ryan shook his head. I made a promise to her mother. With that, Ryan summoned the strength to step out of the car and face his demons. Dressed head to toe in polypropylene suits, they moved in a silent procession through the gleaming entrance foyer, past the wall of postboxes and polished steel doors of the lifts, which Ryan bypassed in favor of taking the stairs. It was a desperate attempt to delay their arrival, to give himself more time to dot he didn't know what. To prepare, he supposed. But nothing could have prepared Ryan for what he saw beyond the bland white-painted front door leading to his penthouse apartment. His hand shook as he tried to insert a brass key into the lock, and it took several attempts before the door swung open. Ryan simply froze, staring at the scene which awaited him. His back was ramrod straight and his face was utterly expressionless as he forced himself to look at the remains of what had once been a girl. Behind him, Lois paled and looked away to allow his system time to adjust to the sight and smell of violent death. Faulkner turned 180 degrees and braced his hands against his knees, taking deep breaths in and out until the urge to vomit subsided. Dear God, Phillips whispered, throat working. He was not a religious man, but he sent up a silent prayer all the same. Faulkner, Ryan said, in a queer, flat tone. Are you ready? The man was breathing hard and had to swallow his own bile, but he pulled himself together and nodded queasily. Phillips, Ryan turned to his sergeant and seemed to look straight through him. Contact Pinter down at the mortuary and tell him to expect a delivery within the hour. Lowison? He turned the same vacant gaze onto the young man whose pallor now matched his white polypropylene suit. Stay here. But, sir. Stay here, Ryan repeated, with finality. You don't need to see this. With that, he took the first step inside. Immediately, the stench of death assaulted him, penetrating his nostrils with its sickly sweet odor. The line between past and present blurred again, and he saw the living room as it had been 2 years ago, before he'd called in a team of decorators to repaint and replace every scrap of furniture, even down to the kitchen units. He saw himself injured on the floor, crawling towards his sister who was seated in a chair in the center of the room, bound and gagged. He saw Edward sitting beside her, brandishing a scalpel. Ryan shook himself, breathing hard through his teeth as memories swarmed his mind. Blood was everywhere. It coated the floor and spattered the walls, concentrated in the center of the room. But the body of the decapitated girl lying in an overturned chair was not his sister. He would not have to make another phone call to his mother, for it was somebody else's daughter he had failed to save this time. In a daze, Ryan scanned the room and found the girl's head sitting grotesquely on the countertop of his open-plan kitchen. Blood pooled in a wide circle around it and had dripped into a congealed puddle on the floor, leaving the flesh on her face an ashen gray. His breathing was becoming erratic, shuddering in and out as he began to hyperventilate, but Ryan wasn't aware of it. He took another shaking step into the room and looked back at the girl's body. Memories flooded in now, engulfing him in a maelstrom of color and sound. His head began to pound and he felt dizzy, black spots dancing in front of his eyes. He groped around for something, anything to take his mind off the horror of that day, but it was too late. All at once, the dead girl was his sister, Natalie. He saw her looking at him with big, gray eyes the same shade as his own, full of terror. Ryan let out a cry and stumbled forward, arms outstretched to prevent the first cut from Edward's scalpel, but before he could collapse to the floor, Two pairs of strong arms shot out to break his fall. "There, lad," Philip soothed. "We've got you." Anna had just booked a short-stay holiday rental in the pretty, rural village of Blankland on the border of Northumberland and County Durham when she received the call from Phillips. She needed no further bidding and, after making a grab for her coat and bag, she took a taxi from SID headquarters to the Royal Victoria Infirmary, arriving less than 15 minutes later. She exited the cab at a run and made directly for the main entrance to Accident and Emergency, where she was directed along a long, narrow ward containing a number of small consultation cubicles separated by patterned curtains in a jarring shade of turquoise. Even if she had not known the cubicle number, she could have found Ryan simply by following the sound of his raised voice. "I don't need an MRI scan." "Ryan?" she called out, and a curtain was promptly swished back to reveal her fiancé standing next to a flustered Phillips and an equally flustered junior doctor. She took a quick survey, noted that he was resting a hand on the wall for support, then exchanged a meaningful look with Phillips. "I hope you're not being difficult," she said, sternly. Ryan scowled at her. "I'm merely trying to explain that it's completely unnecessary for me to be here." "Oh?" Anna affected an air of confusion. "Because I heard that you'd blacked out for 5 minutes and were totally unresponsive." And she'd been worried sick, from the moment Phillips had told her. Ryan pushed a restless hand through the black hair falling across his forehead, then let it fall away again. "Probably because I haven't eaten today," he improvised. "We've been on the go for days and I forgot to eat, that's all." They all knew it was a lie and it was so out of character that it surprised all of them, especially Ryan. He decided to try a different tack and turned his considerable charm towards the young female doctor hovering beside him, making a valiant attempt at doing her job. "Doctor, I really appreciate your help, but I feel I'm wasting your time. There must be many more serious cases." "Knock it off," Anna snapped, and Phillips held back a laugh. "You're wasting the doctor's time by trying to argue your way out of a checkup. Don't think you can charm your way out of it, because I'm not budging from this spot until I know you're all right." Taking her cue, the doctor placed a none too gentle hand on Ryan's arm and nudged him towards the edge of the bed where he was deposited unceremoniously. "Follow this light, please," she instructed him, and Ryan had no choice but to obey or run the risk of looking like a prize moron. Anna was true to her word, standing guard at the entrance of the cubicle until the checkup was complete and he was pronounced fit and well. Having received a brief summary of the circumstances, the doctor gently suggested that Ryan might be suffering from post-traumatic stress and that he should consider talking therapies to help him get through it. After she left them to write up her report, Ryan pushed away from the bed and yanked the curtain back. "The only talking therapy I need is one where I tell Keir Edwards to burn in hell," he gritted out, before striding down the corridor towards the exit. Phillips turned to Anu as they followed behind him at a slower pace. "Edwards killed a girl, the same way he killed Natalie Ryan. He staged the room to look similar, knowing that Ryan would look at it and remember what happened before. He walked in there and relived it all, then just blacked out." He snapped his fingers, to signify a light switching off. "I don't know what to do for the best," he confessed. "What happened today pushed him to the limit, took him right back to a place he's been trying for 2 years to escape. He needs time to recover." "I thought he had," Anna murmured. "I know. If Morrison hears about it, she'll take him straight off the case. Anna watched Ryan's retreating back and gnawed at her inner lip. "Then don't tell her," she said, taking an enormous leap of faith. "Don't tell her, Frank." Phillips searched her face and nodded slowly. "If he doesn't see the investigation through, he'll always know that Edwards beat him. He has to carry on, for his own well-being."
"Exactly.
That's good enough for me," Phillips decided. Anna smiled and reached across to plant a kiss on his ruddy cheek.
"Thanks. Give us a moment."
While Phillips lagged at a discreet distance behind, Anna found Ryan prowling around the waiting area of the A&D department, which was teeming with people considering it was a Tuesday afternoon. She took a deep breath.
"Are you all right?"
He opened his mouth to say something dismissive, but one look at her quelled the impulse. Instead, he simply pulled her into his body, wrapping his arms around her so that they were welded together.
"I feel better now."
"What can I do?" she asked.
"You're doing plenty," he said, then let out a shaky laugh.
"I needed you with me, Anna, just to remind me that there's still some good in the world."
"It's all around you," she pointed out. "You have a good friend in Frank, and in Jack."
"Loison? Who do you think helped Phillips get you to the car?" Ryan said nothing but made a mental note to thank him later.
"I told him to stay out of there," he muttered. "I didn't want him to see what was inside."
"You can't protect him from the world. He chose to become a murder detective, just like you. It comes with the territory." Ryan rubbed his cheek against the top of her head, then drew away to look at her.
"I know you're right.
Sorry, I missed that. Can you write it down on parchment, for posterity?" He chuckled, and it was the most reassuring sound she had heard from him all day. It lit up his eyes and his face creased into a quick silver smile that floored her every time. She rested her hand against his chest, feeling his heart beating strong and sure beneath his cotton shirt.
"Now," she said, "stop loafing around and get back to work."
"Yes, ma'am." Chapter 11. Ryan summoned a patrol car to deliver Anna safely back to SID headquarters, and then he and Phillips headed towards the service stairs leading to the basement mortuary at the infirmary, the province of Dr. Jeffrey Pinter, chief of pathologist. Their heels clicked against the concrete steps as they descended to the lower level and entered a long corridor leading to a set of secure steel doors at the end. The temperature in the corridor was suffocating, thanks to a series of fans expelling hot air in an effort to keep the mortuary consistently cold. As they neared the double doors, Ryan entered a 4-digit code into the security pad on the wall and, after a few seconds, they let out a long buzz and opened automatically. The two men stepped into the large, open-plan mortuary space and shivered as the temperature dropped immediately. Banks of metal drawers lined one wall and a state-of-the-art, electronically controlled immersion tank had recently been installed next to the existing row of gurneys placed at intervals in the center of the room. They detected the unique aroma of formalin and natural gases, which no amount of bleach could ever quite remove and they would forever associate with death. Noses wrinkled, they busied themselves with the task of shrugging into the visitors' coats hanging on a peg beside the door. Ryan scrawled their names in the logbook and they took a moment to don plastic shoe coverings and hairnets to complete their ensemble.
"Very fetching," Phillips said. With the formalities complete, they sought out the man in charge and found him in his office, annex just off the main area. Jeffrey Pinter was tall, gangly and comfortably middle-aged. His hair was thinning around a gaunt, hollow-eyed face, and when he stood up to reveal an overlarge lab coat flapping around his legs, he bore an uncomfortable resemblance to the Grim Reaper. Then his face broke into a welcoming smile and the likeness dissolved. "Ryan Phillips. Good to see you." He gave them both a firm, fist-pumping handshake and didn't seem to notice when both men rubbed their hands against the back of their lab coats immediately afterward. "In a place like this, you could never be too careful. Have you had an opportunity to look at the body?" Ryan asked, not bothering with any small talk. Pinter's face fell back into solemn lines and he clutched the lapels of his coat. "Only briefly," the pathologist replied. "It'll take quite a while to perform a thorough post-mortem, given her condition." There was something horribly prosaic about describing the decapitation of a not-quite-16-year-old girl as a condition, but Phillips tried not to let it bother him. He supposed that Pinter needed to remain objective, just as they did. "Do you want to take a look at her?" Pinter continued, as if he were inviting them to test drive a new car. "I've had her body laid out in a private examination room, just next door." "Tempting, Jeff, but we had a good look earlier," Phillips said, before Ryan had time to react. "Have you been able to confirm her identity, medically, I mean?" "I've sent off the blood work for analysis, but once we cleaned her up a bit we could see a clear physical match with the profile of the missing girl you sent through, Bethany Finnegan." It was no more than he had expected, but Ryan felt grief wash over him all the same. "I don't want her mother brought in until you've taken care of her." He would not budge on that. It was the least he could do for the woman who had lost the most loved and important thing in her life, the only thing that had given it meaning. "I would rather she didn't come in at all, but I don't think she listened to our advice, so just do what you can for her." Pinter nodded judiciously. I don't know whether it will bring much comfort to her mother, or to any of us, but I don't think the girl was alive when her killer removed the head. It's most likely she died from major cardiac arrest brought on by the severity of her other injuries. Every major artery has been severed, as far as I can see, and blood loss on that scale would have weakened her system to such a degree that her heart failed. There is some evidence of clotting around certain sites at her knees and elbows, so it would appear he performed those incisions ante-mortem. There was a short silence in the room as both detectives thought of the pints of wasted blood seeping through the floor of Ryan's apartment. It didn't help that the loud tick-tock of an industrial white clock on the wall seemed to mimic the sound of blood hitting the floor. "How about the murder weapon?" Ryan asked. "Oh, I'd say it was almost certainly a large, serrated knife. I'll be able to give you more specifics after the lab has examined the incision marks around the neck area, but it wasn't a single, clean blow with an axe or anything like that. I'm afraid that, if she had been conscious at the time, it would have been excruciating because it would have taken some time to saw through." "We get the picture." Ryan did not allow himself time to dwell on that prospect. "How about time of death?" "We were the first on the scene, we found her just before 4 o'clock. Pinter let out a theatrical whoosh of breath, causing the two other men in the room to regard him with thinly veiled irritation. "Well, this is only a very rough estimate, but I'd say that the post-mortem interval was anywhere up to 15 or 16 hours by the time you found her, which would put her death at around midnight last night," Ryan murmured.
Yes. Her body is already in quite an advanced stage of rigor, and her core temperature was ambient when she was brought into us. Bearing in mind that the body cools at a rate of around 1.5 degrees Celsius per hour, and factoring in variables like her size, the likely stoop in core temperature as she suffered cardiac arrest. It's difficult, but I'd still say roughly 15 hours. That would tie in with what we already know about her movements, Phillips observed, thinking of the statements they had taken from Beth's friends. Pinter rocked back on his heels, waiting to deliver the most exciting piece of information he had discovered. It was another one of his little habits that they had come to expect over the course of their working relationship, and it was fortunate that they could offset his many idiosyncrasies against the fact that he happened to be the most experienced and capable pathologist within 100 miles. "There's something else and you're not going to like it." He gestured them towards the computer screen on his desk and brought up a recent photograph taken of the girl's body. "Take a look at this." And there, written in plain black ink on the palm of Bethany's left hand, was an 8-letter word. "Envictus." Phillips leaned in to inspect the photograph and then turned back to the other two men in the room with a look of consternation on his face. "What does it mean? I feel like I've heard it before." "It's Latin," Ryan explained. "It means unvanquished." Phillips raised a single bushy eyebrow. "Latin lessons twice a week when I was at school," Ryan elaborated. "Oh, I forgot you went to one of those posh gaffs. I bet you never thought it would actually come in useful, though. For a dead language, it's a remarkably popular choice for a certain brand of egotistical serial killer," Ryan agreed. Phillips had to smile. "Why can't these fruitcakes use plain English? They always have to have the last word and it always has to be melodramatic." "It's completely in keeping with his character," Ryan said. "He wants to be noticed, admired and feared. Latin allows him to project a veneer of intelligence. Unvanquished. Is it a show of supremacy or defiance?" Phillips considered the psychology of the man they hunted. "Everything about this girl's death was a show of supremacy. It was all staged especially for you to find." He nodded at Ryan. "The way I see it, he's sending out a challenge." A muscle ticked in Ryan's jaw as he looked at the image on the screen. "In that case, I accept." Mackenzie heard the soft tread of footsteps on the stairs and hurriedly stripped off her support splint, stuffing it underneath the bed before he entered the room. She sat meekly on the edge and waited for him to unlock the door. "Dinner time, Ruth," he sang out, holding out a cracked plate with a meager portion of what looked and smelled like tinned anchovies. She accepted the plate with demure thanks and immediately began to force it down her throat, hating the salty taste of fish that had been embalmed in brine for too long. She chewed methodically, reminding herself that her body required fuel and silently reciting Yeats to take her mind off its rancid flavor. "Though I am old with wandering, through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone, and kiss her lips and take her hands." The poetry reminded her of Frank, and she wondered where he was and if he thought she was dead already. Then Edwards clicked his fingers in front of her face, demanding her attention. "Ruth, pay attention when I'm talking to you. Rudeness is most unbecoming." Mackenzie didn't bother to point out the obvious fact that he was hardly qualified to comment on manners or much else relating to the human condition. "I beg your pardon.
Edwards seemed to accept her apology at face value or else decided to ignore the sarcasm leaking from every pore. That's better. If you'd been listening, you'd have heard me telling you that I'll be going out again tonight. Now, I know what you're thinking. He wagged his finger at her and dropped down on one knee so that his face was less than 5 inches away from hers. Mackenzie recoiled and the plate clattered to the floor. "TSK, TSK," he said. "Look at the mess you've made." "Sorry," she muttered. "I'll clean it up." "Yes, you will," he said patiently. "When I return, I'd like to see this room spick and span, and you sitting right here where I left you. Is that understood?" Mackenzie's lips trembled. "Yes." He sighed dramatically and flicked a finger across her nose in the kind of casually intimate gesture that made her stomach turn. "I can read you like a book," he said, with a malicious smile. "I know that, as soon as my back is turned, you'll be thinking of how you can scamper away across the hillside to find your knight in shining armor." He paused and cocked his head. "Incidentally, where is the good sergeant? Surely, if he really cared, he would have come to save you by now." Mackenzie told herself not to react. His words were calculated to hurt and to undermine her resolve. She must not react. "I don't need anybody to save me," she surprised them both by saying, and Edwards bared his teeth in something resembling a smile. "Feisty. I do like that about you," he confessed. "Practical, too, because, and let's not beat around the bush, it's no use helping for a savior. I could kill you very easily, whenever I choose." He said it so nonchalantly that it took her breath away. Suddenly, Edwards sighed again and rose to his feet, raising an arm to stretch out the muscles across his back. She watched him stroll to the window and look down at the patch of ground he had designated as an exercise yard. "I hope you've been enjoying the view," he threw a wink over his shoulder. Mackenzie looked away, feeling bilious. It could have been the anchovies, but she suspected it was the thought of Edwards attempting some form of mild flirtation with her, for some malevolent reason known only to himself. "You know, Ruth, if you're feeling lonely at night, you can always just tap on the wall and I'll be happy to oblige," he continued, watching the changing expressions on her face. Fear came first, followed by some other emotion he didn't understand, nor had any particular inclination to try to decipher. Frankly, the effort of feigning ordinary human empathy was something he no longer felt obligated to do. Then she surprised him again. "Perhaps you're the one who's lonely," she said, turning her cat-like green eyes on him. Mackenzie felt her stomach quiver as the silence stretched on and she worried she had gone too far. During the long hours spent on her own, she had considered the possibility of striking up a rudimentary connection with her captor, to test whether anything remained of Ear Edwards, the man. Now, she could see aggression warring with curiosity and she assumed aggression would be the natural victor, so she prepared herself for further injury as punishment for her audacity. The silence thrummed for long seconds, then he relaxed his frame against the wall and crossed his arms across his chest in a manner that reminded her unnervingly of Ryan. "And what makes you think I am lonely, sweetheart?" Her skin itched at the sound of another endearment from the lips of a killer, but she concentrated on saying the right things and providing him with a response that would be acceptable. "It must be difficult," she said, searching for the words to convey the right amount of implied sympathy for a man she considered no better than a wild animal. In fact, he was worse. At least animals killed to defend themselves or to survive. He took lives for the sheer joy of it. It must be difficult, she tried again. To what? To be me? He offered, pointing a finger at his own chest. He threw back his head and laughed, long and hard. Let me tell you something about myself, he said conversationally, once the laughter dried up. I look just the same as other men, other exceptional men. I have arms and legs, 2 ears, 10 fingers and toes. He wriggled his fingers and moved towards her again. Mackenzie's heart hammered against the wall of her chest as he drew nearer, and she felt his rage growing stronger with every step. This body, he gestured to himself, is nothing more than a superficial shell. I like to hone it, to keep it running smoothly, but it's just the suit that I wear every day. Underneath it, there isn't a single thing that connects me to the rest of you. Nothing remotely resembling emotion, at least, not in the way you mean. I look at you, sitting there shaking with fear, and I feel nothing. Do you understand? Not an inordinate sense of achievement, or even the kind of pleasure I was hoping for. I feel nothing, Denise. Not love, not hate, not pity, not pain. The only thing I feel is an urge to find out what your insides look like and how long it would take your pretty green eyes to die. The urge is getting stronger every day, so much so that I barely see you as a person. You're just a mass of flesh and bone. He came to stand in front of her and dropped back down so that she could feel his warm breath against her face. So, he said, very softly. Why don't you ask me again if you think I feel lonely? Mackenzie could not move from her position on the bed for a long time after he left. Partly, she was fearful that he would return and remember the reason he had visited in the first place, to incapacitate her somehow and remove her ability to walk or run. The other reason was the degrading knowledge that, at some point during his introspective monologue, she had wet herself. Tears leaked from the corners of her eyes, but she dashed them away because she had achieved a small success, whether he realized it or not. Edwards had not attacked her, and he had also called her Denise for the first time, unconsciously reinstating an aspect of her identity that he had tried so hard to remove. She wondered if he was even aware of it. Outside, night had fallen and a light rain pattered against the roof above her head, filtering through the open window so that the room was not only cold but damp. She raised herself from the bed, cleaned herself up as best she could, and when she heard him leave, whistling to himself as he rounded the side of the house, she trained herself to fight again. Chapter 12. Ryan found Jack Lewison hovering outside the back entrance to SID headquarters, sucking deeply from an apple-flavored e-cigarette. He stood beneath the smoker's canopy listening to the sound of rain hitting the plastic roof, while he looked out at the unappealing vista that was the staff car park. Ryan tucked his hands into the pockets of his jacket and walked across to stand beside him. I wanted to thank you, Jack. Lewison took a long drag of his cigarette and it bubbled like a shisha, emitting a faint aroma of golden delicious. Ryan smiled to himself, thinking that the man had certainly learned a thing or two about the value of silence in drawing people out. I wasn't myself earlier today, and I know you and Phillips were there for me when I passed out. I appreciate it, and I want you to know the reason I didn't want you working the scene had nothing to do with your capabilities. Lewison maintained his silence, and Ryan supposed he should congratulate himself on having taught him so well, but he hadn't anticipated that his own methods would be used against him one day. All right, you're angry. You've a right to be, Ryan bit out, and watched surprise flit across the other man's face. I was wrong to shut you out, but I won't apologize for wanting to protect you from the worst damage one human being is capable of inflicting on another. Loison took a final drag of his e-cig and then tucked it into the breast pocket of his suit jacket, which still carried a lingering scent of death from earlier in the day. He imagined he would continue to smell it, long after the suit was dry cleaned. I understand why you wanted to keep me out. But you need to understand that I chose this job for the same reasons as you. I can't get any better at it if you wrap me up in cotton wool. Ryan inclined his head. Just one last thing, Loison said. Next time, if you're going to fall like a redwood, give us some bloody warning. I nearly put my back out making a dive for you. Noted. Phillips ended the call and let his mobile fall onto the desktop in disgust, replaying the conversation he'd just had. Durham Sidri interviewed the helicopter pilot, Andy Hayworth, and his wife earlier in the day, but hours had passed without any update. Feeling impatient, he had taken matters into his own hands and put a call through to the detective in charge. Detective Inspector Bill Rogers was close to retirement, with nearly 40 years on the force. He knew how to run an investigation and didn't appreciate being taught how to suck eggs, even by someone he respected as much as Frank Phillips. Was it his fault if the pilot's wife couldn't remember any more details about her attack? The woman was traumatized, for heaven's sake. In truth, Rogers knew the real reason Helen Hayworth refused to talk. It had nothing to do with trauma and everything to do with fearing that her life, or the lives of her husband and son, might be in danger if she blabbed. He'd seen it dozens of times before and said as much to Phillips. You and I both know what's happened here, Frank, but we've tried pushing the wife and she's not budging an inch. As far as she's concerned, it was a muscular man of average height and mid-brown hair who turned up on her doorstep, pretending to be selling steam cleaning services. He talked his way inside under the pretense of needing to use the loo, following which he got hold of her little boy and told her to pack a bag. He threatened to hurt the boy if she didn't do as he said, so she hopped to it and got inside his blue van. She thinks it had a white steam cleaning logo on the side. He took her and the boy for a long drive, during which time they were kept in the back, out of sight. He kept driving and didn't stop except to let her hunker down beside the road and relieve herself a couple of times, then dropped them off the morning after it was all over beside the junction at Scotch Corner, and the rest you already know. That's all she will say. She must be able to tell us something about his accent, his name, his clothing, Phillips scabbled. Have you shown her some photos of the usual suspects? At the other end of the line, Rogers rolled his eyes. Aye, Frank, we have. She claims that none of them are the man who abducted her and the little un. Give me strength, Phillips had muttered. What about the pilot? As for the pilot, he only saw Edwards in person, and you know all there is to know about that, Rogers pointed out. If the wife has told her husband anything about her mystery abductor, he's keeping shtum as well. Bill, please. This could mean the difference between finding Denise and losing her. At the other end of the line, Rogers pinched the bridge of his nose. I know it, Frank. But if we push that family any harder, anything they tell us won't stand up in court. We'll have some snotty little defense barrister quoting chapter and verse from the Police and Criminal Evidence Act about intimidation of witnesses, and that'll be all it takes to throw everything to the wind. Besides, Bill said, there's a very real danger of harm.
It's a small community, up here in the Northeast. If Helen Hayworth points the finger at who's responsible, whoever was the money and brains behind it all will find out pretty quickly, and the repercussions for that family could be devastating. Truth be told, Frank, I might do the same thing myself, if I were her. With Roger's words ringing in his ears, Phillips had hung up the phone and resigned himself to a process of elimination. He turned his mind to the question of who was responsible for helping the hacker break free. Whose reputation generated enough fear to prevent the Hayworths from giving a clear description of their attacker? It could only be somebody well known in the area as being a dangerous entity. According to the National Criminal Intelligence Service, there were about 40 organized criminals operating in the Northeast, but he would have said the number was closer to 50 or 60, most of whom belonged to two or three ruling gangland families operating in Newcastle, Gateshead, Sunderland, and Durham. They mostly ran protection rackets and facilitated drug trafficking through the control of pubs and clubs throughout the region, but one or two of the more sophisticated outfits were branching out from the kind of traditional, enterprising crimes that Phillips remembered in the old days, towards financial crimes like counterfeiting and fraud. He picked up his biro and spent some time drawing a detailed network of what he already knew to be in operation, in Newcastle and Durham particularly. Ere Edwards had been careful in his communications with his solicitor, Phillips thought, and had only slipped up once by sending an email setting out Mackenzie's address and when the notes should be delivered to have maximum impact. There were no telephone recordings to the solicitor's firm and no other written communications to give so much as a hint of who was funding Edwards' escape. If Edwards had money squirreled away somewhere waiting for him, he might have made a promise of payment to his mysterious benefactor in exchange for services rendered. But with three significant criminal families operating in the region, all of them with the means to intimidate witnesses and procure a helicopter, it was going to take more than a prayer to flush out the rat. He was going to have to make some house calls. Phillips was nowhere to be seen when Ryan called his final briefing of the day at 7:30. His core staff were all present and even Anna had been smuggled into a seat in the corner of the incident room under heavy camouflage, in deference to the fact that Chief Constable Morrison was liable to pay them an unexpected visit at any time and would not be impressed if she found a civilian among their number. Jack. Have you seen Phillips? Lowison shook his head. Not for the last half hour. I think he mentioned something about getting a bit of fresh air. Ryan thought it was unusual that his sergeant hadn't informed him of his movements, considering the mountain they still had to climb, but he supposed he shouldn't begrudge the man a break. He was going through hell and was handling it in a more dignified fashion than most. Fair enough, he said, to the room at large. Let's crack on. Ryan rolled up his shirt sleeves and folded his arms while he collected his thoughts. All right, here's the roundup. As of this morning, we have Edwards' second vehicle impounded and the CSIs have gone over it already. We're waiting for the lab results to confirm a DNA match. But it's looking very likely that the Toyota RAV4 was left at the Stifford roundabout, we don't know when or by whom, and picked up by Edwards in the early hours of last Tuesday after he dumped Mackenzie's Fiesta. They drove to an unknown destination, where Edwards has been holing up until finally rearing his ugly head again last night. Ryan paused to take a swig of coffee, buying himself enough time to prepare for the next part of his roundup. As you can see, there's a new photograph on the wall, he said quietly, and watched their heads turn to look at the color photograph of Bethany Finnegan, provided by her mother when she thought her daughter was merely missing. This is Beth,
and she was a week away from her 16th birthday when she died sometime around midnight last night. He let his gaze travel around the room, burning them. Beth was decapitated and her body mutilated, but not in any kind of frenzy attack. Her injuries were inflicted with the steady, knowledgeable hand of someone with advanced anatomical knowledge, using something like a common bread knife. There were quiet gasps around the room as some of his staff flipped the pages in their printed packs and stumbled across images taken from the crime scene earlier that day. The pathologist is performing a post-mortem this evening and will get a report to us as soon as possible, but it will likely be days before the CSIs have completed a full sweep of the crime scene. It would take them that long to wade through the blood. Incidentally, Edwards chose to use my old apartment as his first kill site after unleashing himself back into society. There were some who already knew about it, but for those who hadn't yet heard it on the police grapevine, their faces registered shock. There was also a healthy degree of curiosity, as Ryan had anticipated. Needless to say, his choice of location was a meaningful one. He kept his voice firm and was relieved that it didn't waver. "I don't need to go over old ground, but this is the second time Ear Edwards has chosen my digs for his dirty work. After we've kicked the prison door shut on him for the second time, remind me to forward him the cleaning bill," he added, dryly. The unexpected touch of dark humor came as a welcome relief to his staff, who were glad to find something to laugh about, if only briefly. As for Ryan, he was tired of feeling like a victim and didn't need or want their pity. "Our working theory is that Edwards drove into Durham to attack my fiancée at her cottage. Since we have temporarily relocated to a safe house, he found the place empty and had to settle for ransacking it instead. There were no signs of forced entry at my apartment at Wharf Square, so we have to assume he found the spare set of keys whilst he was rummaging through drawers at the cottage and was able to let himself in later on. After he finished looting, Edwards started a fire at the cottage at 10 o'clock or thereabouts and took a drive into Newcastle. When he arrived, he parked obstructively across the entrance to the Copthorne Hotel on the quayside, and we have CCTV footage of him exiting the Toyota at 22:24. He then proceeded to walk the short distance to Eddie's Beach Club, where he met Beth Finnegan and lured her away from her friends by 11 o'clock. We have footage of them walking along the quayside heading east, arriving at the front entrance to my apartment building at Wharf Square at 11:15. Ryan felt his stomach muscles tense and he reached across to pick up a paper clip to give himself something to cling to while he covered the necessary ground. There are several points to note. Firstly, Edwards is unconcerned by the fact that we now have an updated image of his physical appearance, which clearly shows he is feeling brazen, not to mention opportunistic. Ryan pointed to another photograph tacked to the wall, which showed Edwards clean-shaven, wearing what looked to be dark clothing. He felt the breath catch in his throat as another thought struck him, and he wandered across to the murder board to take a closer look at the man's clothes. "Oh, please, no." He turned back to his audience with a face like thunder. A detailed description of the crime scene, including Beth's injuries, has been included in your packs. For now, let's just say he acted with extreme violence, as with all his previous victims. Furthermore, her body was deliberately staged to resemble the death of Natalie Finlay Ryan, my sister. Nobody spoke, and the air seemed suddenly so still that he couldn't breathe. "Ah, can I ask a question?" His grateful eyes sought out the source, and when he found it, he smiled into Anna's eyes, drawing strength from their strength. "Go ahead,
We'll say you're an honorary member of the team for the duration. In that case, can you tell me how Edwards managed to get back out of the city? Wouldn't he have been covered in blood? Ryan felt the constriction in his chest begin to abate. We don't actually know for sure that he has left the city, Ryan pointed out, and his voice carried a warning. Likewise, he might have stolen a change of clothes whilst he was at our house in Durham. However, it's likely that he either found somewhere nearby to hide out, or he managed to procure another vehicle. We're checking for vehicles reported stolen in the area, Lowison put in. I'll let you know when we have something. Ryan nodded. Start with the residence, he said. The CCTV beside the entrance to Wharf Square captured Edwards coming inside with Beth, but there's no record of him leaving again. If he was covered in blood and wanted to keep a low profile, it would make sense for him not to wander too far. I noticed today that there was a camera overlooking the residence car park at the rear of the building, so I want to know why I don't have that footage on my desk. Some of the support staff exchanged worried looks. It's been vandalized, Lowison explained. So we don't have any footage of the car park for the relevant period. Of course it has, Ryan said darkly. Find out when that camera was broken, because I'll take odds that it went down sometime around midnight last night. I want to see any remaining footage prior to the breakage, see which cars were parked outside and check them all to see if they're still with their respective owners. Lowison wrote a hasty note on it. Like many killers with narcissistic tendencies, Edwards has chosen to leave a calling card with his latest victim. The word Invictus was written in black marker pen on Beth's left palm. Translated from the Latin, it means unvanquished. We can only assume that Edwards intended it to be a defiant gesture, once again part of the staging of his victim. There were murmurs of disgust around the room. Trace his mode of transport and we'll be able to trace him, Ryan reminded them, and waited a beat before clapping his hands together. Let's go. As they were galvanized into action, Ryan checked the time on the clock on the wall against his watch. Both read 8:15 and there was still no sign of Phillips. Chapter 13. The streets were dark and soaked with rain when Phillips returned to Buddle's boxing gym. Unlike Ryan, he didn't have any trouble finding it among the rows of identical streets on the borders of Benwell and Elswick, in Newcastle's West End. It had been many years since he'd played on these streets as a boy, and perhaps too many since he had been back to pay them a visit, but there was still a sense of homecoming. There was nowhere else in the world he could be himself, or at least the version of himself he used to be when he'd been a scrapper, a stocky kid with no direction and plenty of time on his hands. Nowadays, he had no family to bring him back to Benwell. His father died years ago, and by the time his mother passed away, he'd already moved out of the area with his late wife, Laura. He'd been on the way to passing his detective's exam and they'd moved so that he could be closer to work. They never had any children but life became busier all the same, and there had been less time to drive across town for an early morning sparring session at Buddle's. When Laura had become ill with the cancer that eventually killed her, he hadn't wanted to be away from her any longer than necessary and he had no time for boxing matches and pints down at the Pig and Whistle. But his body remembered the old feeling of being in the ring, even if he was a bit out of condition. It had felt good to come back yesterday, not only to rid himself of some of the grief and frustration of his present nightmare but simply to feel alive. This time, though, he hadn't come to fight.
Phillips walked through the main entrance into the gymnasium and shook hands with some of the boxers stretching on mats or training with pads. He didn't stop to chat but continued past the ring where he and Ryan had recently gone the round, to a small office area bearing a plaque that said Managar. The letter E had been missing for as long as he could remember and he'd been coming on and off since it first opened in the early 70s. The door had been left open to reveal a group of four men sitting in front of a high-end flat-screen television, watching the recording of a recent fight. He glanced at the screen and recognized both fighters as local champions. "Knock knock," he said, stepping into the room. "Yoel Reet, Frank," one of them replied, without turning around. Phillips waited patiently until the fight was over and the recording came to an end. These men took their boxing seriously and the presence of a detective sergeant from Northumbria Sid wasn't enough to divert their attention. Only when it had finished did they turn and greet him properly, faces creasing into smiles. "Frank. Ye old bugger, where've you been?" They exchanged hard, backslapping hugs and handshakes, some token words of sympathy about Denise, and then three of the men left following a swift jerk of the manager's head, closing the door behind them. "Frank. I was sorry to hear about Denise." Harry Donnelly Jr. was a man of diminutive height but enormous local stature. He owned several investment properties in upmarket areas of Newcastle but preferred to live in the same house he had grown up in, not far from the gym. He was in his mid-50s, like Frank, but instead of a dark grey suit, he wore a pair of straight leg jeans and a tight white t-shirt which stretched over a muscular beer belly. His arms were hairy and tanned almost to leather from his twice-yearly holidays to a timeshare in Marbella, and there were deep crow's feet around his astute blue eyes. His father, Harry S.R., had founded Buddles sometime in the early 70s after the closure of Manors Hall, a legendary boxing venue which had been open since the 1920s right up until its demolition to make way for a new metro station in the late 1960s. In his heyday, Harry Sr. had trained some of the local boxing greats and had even sparred with Cassius Clay,